Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain. Those of us working to address climate change and income inequality have a powerful new ally in Pope Francis. During the Pope's recent visit to the United States, he spoke powerfully about the need to work together to address these challenges. Our guest today has been working hard to create solutions to both climate change and income inequality. In fact, she is a powerful advocate for solutions to climate change that at the same time reduce income inequality. Kia Chatterjee is Executive Director of U.S. CAN, also known as U.S. Climate Action Network. Her work focuses on building an inclusive movement in support of climate action. Kia recently appeared in the documentary Disruption, promoting the People's Climate March. Kia's commentary on climate change policy and sustainability issues has been quoted in dozens of media outlets, including USA Today, The New York Times, Fox News, The Associated Press, The Washington Post, and more. She is the author of a book, The Zero Footprint Baby, How to Save the Planet While Raising a Healthy Baby. Prior to joining U.S. CAN, Kia served as Senior Director for Renewable Energy and Footprint Outreach at the World Wildlife Fund. Before that, Kia was a climate change specialist at USAID. She also worked at NASA headquarters for 4 years, communicating research results on climate change. Kia received her master's degree in environmental science and her bachelor's in environmental science and Spanish from the University of Virginia. Kia Chatterjee, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a great pleasure. I'm so excited to have you here. I mean, how wonderful that you're able to join us today right in the wake of Pope Francis's visit to America. So thank you for being here.
So, thank you. It has been an exciting time.
Yes. So we know there are hundreds of organizations working on climate change. Tell us about U.S. Climate Action Network and what your network does.
Sure. So we are a network of 156 organizations around the U.S. That work to promote action on climate change. So we have a big chunk of our members, a caucus, if you will, that are faith organizations from different denominations and interfaith groups as well. We have a big chunk of groups that work on social and economic justice issues primarily, like the NAACP or the Center for Popular Democracy. And then we have a group of members that are environmental groups like the Sierra Club, Greenpeace, World Wildlife Fund, National Wildlife Federation, that are sometimes the groups that people think of first when they think of climate organizations. But our network actually spans a range of different constituencies. And our role is just to give people who are all working on the same issue a way of communicating with each other, finding out what each other are doing, and making sure that among all the groups that are working on climate change, we're stronger together than we would be if we weren't working across organizations to advance our cause.
This is so exciting to hear what you're talking about because, you know, we all know there's, you know, so many different groups and people, particularly funders, often wonder, why do we need another group? But I think it's fantastic that you've got this U.S. CAN and creating kind of a strategic hub for all the groups that are interested in acting on climate change. So congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Our organization has actually been around for 26 years, and we're the U.S. node of our network. And so what's exciting is that we not only have all the organizations in the U.S. that are working on climate, but then we also have a network in every region of the world and all over the world. So we are one of over 20 what we call nodes around the world. So there's CAN Latin America and CAN South Asia. These are all the climate action networks around the world that bring together groups that are working from the neighborhood and grassroots level all the way up to the international level. And a lot of what we do also is help our groups connect with those around the world who are working on similar things and connect to international processes.
That's fantastic. So you could have a group, for example, you've got the one in Massachusetts that's working at the state level there, but then through your organization they can connect with what else is happening in the U.S. and around the world.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, it's a way of sharing information so that we can be better and faster and more nimble. And there's a lot of interesting network theory that shows that, you know, if all of our member organizations were one organization, we would actually be less powerful. The idea of a network is that people are able to focus on the thing that they're doing, but they have enough information to be able to pick up the phone and call an organization when they need a piece of information, and it's far more nimble and fast. And the reality is that we are responding and have to respond to attacks that come at such a rapid clip, you know, whether you think about, you know, these are just manufactured crises, whether you're thinking about, you know, Solyndra or Climate Gate, or, you know, we're constantly having these manufactured crises, thrown at us. And we're much more nimble as a network than I think we would be otherwise. So I think it's great that there are so many organizations working on climate. And the great thing also is that we're seeing that grow really, really quickly. There are more and more organizations working on climate every day. Just since I joined U.S. Climate Action Network a year ago, we've added, I think, almost 30 member organizations since then. So it's definitely become more mainstream for organizations to start weighing in on climate action and the need for action on climate change.
I think that's fantastic, and I agree. It's good to have lots of the different groups because each group really can speak to its own constituency. The people who would resonate with the message and actions of Greenpeace, for example, wouldn't be the same constituency that the Sierra Club is speaking to. And yet we need to have everybody really working on climate change. In a sense, you know, you see the importance of the problem of climate change. You'd say no matter what issue you're working on, climate change should be your number two issue, and you should be involved in it, because unless we solve that issue, nothing else much is going to matter.
Yeah, and we've definitely seen a lot of that happening, where we have groups that are primarily focused on international development, but they realize, and this was just actually recognized as we were setting the global goals in the UN process over the last week, is that all our goals of ending hunger are incredibly important, of making sure people have access to water. All of these basic goals are incredibly important, but they can't be met unless we tackle climate change, because essentially the reason people care so much about climate change is not, it's kind of been a misnomer about saving Earth. Really what it's about is saving ourselves. You know, when the climate changes too fast in too short a period of time, what we're really putting at risk is food security, because we human beings evolved under a certain climate and are used to raising food in a certain way. That gets put at risk when things change, and water security gets put at risk. And so these are pretty core issues. And of course, you know, this is something that within the community there's a lot of awareness about. I don't know, outside of our network, how much people realize there are massively disproportionate impacts of climate change. And so what we see is that communities of color and low-income communities are hit much, much worse by the impacts of climate change than communities that are well-off. So there's a massive equity and justice issue in play as well.
So talk a little bit more about that. I know we've seen some of that in the news and some in the various conferences about low-income communities are being hit more by climate change. Can you say how that is so? Because you think about it, you think, well, we've got a drought in California, we've got the floods in other places, the hurricanes of increasing intensity. So, but that hits everybody, doesn't it? So how is it that you see that low-income communities are affected more by climate change?
It does hit everybody, but what happens is the vulnerable suffer the most. And so if you think about Superstorm Sandy or Hurricane Katrina, and even in this country, you could just kind of close your eyes and picture who was the most devastated by those events, and they were communities of color and low-income people. If you look at any kind of jobs that are directly related to agriculture, a lot of those communities that are working in fields are low-income communities and communities of color, and they're the most affected when yields are low. They're directly affected. They're the most affected when there are heat waves, and there are job losses in their community in addition to lives at stake. You know, like when there are massive heat waves in cities in this country, people die, and it disproportionately it's communities that are already vulnerable, and not just low-income communities and communities of color, also those that are vulnerable in our society, so older people and younger people. And as a mom myself, like, that's something that really motivates me, is not just that, you know, that young people are more affected and need further protections, but also there's an inequity issue here between generations, what we call intergenerational inequity, where we're doing something in our generation that is going to make the lives of our children and grandchildren worse in the way we're acting now, and has the opportunity to make the lives of our children and grandchildren far better if we take the path of renewable energy and using the climate crisis to cope with solutions that also tackle poverty and massive inequalities that we have in our society today.
Right. That sounds really great. And, you know, you've got the 156 different groups and all working together. Can you talk a little bit about some of the common goals? What are you bringing people together to do? Like, that seems like such a huge issue dealing with this climate change. What are the common goals of the people in the group?
Well, I think there's a lot of things we have in common. One thing we have in common across our membership is that we are, as organizations, very motivated by the moral obligation to act. And this is something that the Pope articulated very clearly, as well as the Islamic Declaration on Climate Change and the rabbinical papers that have been put out. But even beyond our faith membership and our environmental membership and our economic justice membership, we, as a community, we tend to be motivated by this moral obligation to act to our children, to our grandchildren, and to those who have done the least to cause this problem. And that really holds us together. And I think another thing that holds us together is, as a community, we know that we can get this done. We understand that there is opposition. We understand that the fossil fuel companies do not want us to get this done. But we have absolute, you know, we are very familiar with the numbers in terms of what needs to be done on emissions and what needs to be done in terms of getting off of fossil fuels, and we know that we can do it. And that is a core belief that I think is incredibly important that we share as a community. We can get this done. We can make a transition off of fossil fuels and do it in a just and fair way that helps the people who would be directly affected by that transition and brings them along in that transition and get to a better place on the other side.
Yeah, that sounds great. And so you're working for this shift from the fossil fuels to renewables, from the dirty energy to the clean energy, working to reduce U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. How are we doing, by the way, on U.S. greenhouse gas emissions? Are they still rising, but rising at a slower rate, or where do we stand right now?
They have, in the period of the Obama administration, they have come down. But there are fluctuations from year to year that are related to, you know, things like how cold a winter has been or how hot a summer has been. The general trend is going down. And for us, one of the most important things that happened last year, and this is a real game changer, for the first time in history, we had GDP we had absolute emissions stay flat globally, not just in the U.S., but globally. Emissions stayed flat, and that was not related to an economic crisis for the first, that's happened before, but it was in the past related to some kind of economic downturn. There was no economic downturn. The economy was not a factor in this, but emissions stayed flat, and that's really the signal that's incredibly important. We're starting to do it in the U.S. We're starting to implement the policies we need. We have a ways to go. We've got some targets in place. But, you know, it's going to be a big part of how we make decisions in the coming years, whether or not we continue to go down this path. Obviously, things are really different in New York or California, where there's incredible progress being made on many fronts, versus in, say, North Carolina or Florida, where you have in North Carolina the renewable portfolio standard on the chopping block right now for no ostensible reason other than people playing politics. You know, this is a state that has that coastline that's incredibly vulnerable to climate change and has an economy that would benefit enormously from this renewable energy. And so these local struggles that are happening all over the country add up to whether or not we do what we need to do. What we're seeing is incredible progress at the city level in many of the states, and at the federal level, an unprecedented effort happening. And none of it is enough yet, but it's a good start.
Right, exactly. So, you know, we've got some momentum going. I've been impressed watching this over a period of decades now, that the whole move to solar power, for example. You know, decades ago, solar power was around, and, you know, Jimmy Carter famously put the solar panels in the White House. But it was so expensive that people couldn't afford to do it, even if they wanted to. But now the cost of solar is way down, and making it much more accessible to people on a wider income. And then that's creating jobs for people here to install those. So what do you see happening in the solar market right now in the U.S.?
Well, it's just phenomenal. I mean, for the first time ever, we see solar outcompeting fossil fuels on price. That's happening with wind as well. Solar is more available to individual households. So, you know, the prices came down about 80% over a five-year period recently. So I always tell people, like, you know, if you saw a T-shirt that was 80% off and you've been wanting it for a while, you might look again and consider getting it once it had that 80% off sign. And that's essentially what's happening with solar now. Costs have come down dramatically, largely as a factor of, you know, economies of scale, of a lot of production happening. A lot of production was happening for Germany and Spain and Italy and Portugal and some of the countries in Europe that are already pushing 30-40% renewable energy, and we're really benefiting from that massive production. Prices have come down dramatically, and in about 16 states, you don't have to put any money down or pay anything to get solar at this point. So it's really incredible how fast that's happening, both at a residential scale and at a utility scale. It's a huge part of why I believe we'll get to where we need to be.
Yeah, it's great. And of the companies that you mentioned there who are doing the production and the solar panels, let us not forget China, which has really been going gangbusters on producing the solar panels. And what's happening here with producing solar panels in the U.S.? I know we invented the whole solar industry here in the U.S., and now it seems like we're being eclipsed by both Europe and China in producing them. Do you see much hope for manufacturing jobs in the U.S. in that, or are we going to mostly be installing what's made in other countries?
Well, there is manufacturing, and there are solar panels back on the White House now, which are U.S.-made panels, and there are companies like SunPower that manufacture in the U.S. And manufacture solar panels in the U.S., and those are available. You know, it's hard to guess how these things will go. It all just depends, you know, what we choose to invest in and how we set our policies up. You know, there is some manufacturing here already. One of the things that's been interesting in watching the process in Germany, they have a policy that they call Energiewende, which is their energy transition. And what they found is that most of the jobs that are created are actually sales, installation, marketing jobs, and are not manufacturing jobs. And so even if you look at the total amount of jobs created, a lot of them are in the sales and marketing and installation end of the process. And so the jobs will be there. And you know, certainly my hope is that there would be manufacturing jobs as well.
Right. Well, that, it's just amazing to see. I think it's really been within the past decade that the price of solar has just, you know, dropped so much, and it's exciting. I think we've kind of reached a tipping point there where price of solar is down enough that it is truly competitive with fossil fuels now. So that's an exciting place to be.
It is. It's really exciting. And, you know, a lot of exciting stuff has happened in the last few years. But I think wind and solar coming down below fossil fuels has been incredibly exciting. And then, of course, most recently seeing these huge commitments from China has been incredibly exciting. And the Pope's moral call to action. Most recently, we had Shell announcing that they were abandoning their plans to drill in the Arctic. And so, you know, these are the things that, you know, that it's one small victory after another that gets us to where we need to be, and we are getting there.
Yeah, it's impressive to see. And I don't know if you've got this in all, when you talk about U.S. can be a strategic hub for the climate change movement and you're connected locally, nationally, globally. Do you have a particular campaign around a particular focus of what you want the network to do, or is it more kind of working in the different arenas and just seeing where people can support each other on particular things that the organizations are doing?
We have two campaigns right now. One is focused on an event that's coming up very soon. One is on October 14th. We have a website that's at peoplesclimate.org, and it's brought together by the organizers of the People's Climate March in New York City, which happened a little bit over a year ago. And we have about 100 events registered. We're almost at 100. Our goal is 100. I think we're at this morning, as of this morning, at 97. But we plan to have 100 events registered all over this country, where people can go and really get together, have a demonstration, have an event where we are sending a very, very clear message at the local level all over this country that we are tired of the climate denial and we are ready for action. And, you know, there's a policy term called putting a price on carbon that we use a lot in our world, which means, you know, asking people to pay for pollution. And Al Gore said yesterday, you know, if we want a price on carbon, we have to put a price on denial. And that is a big part of our October 14th People's Climate Movement campaign, is to put a price on denial, and also to bring people together in community all over this country and do so in a way that is in solidarity with the actions that will be happening all over the world on November 29th. So that's one of our campaigns. And then, of course, we're also really focused on the UN climate talks in Paris. And so a big part of our focus right now is enabling all of our member organizations at whatever scale they work on to plug in and be able to support getting as much as we can out of that process. You know, the global goal that's been set by world leaders is this goal of 2 degrees. So it's keeping global average surface temperatures below 2 degrees Celsius. So we'll be pushing to create an infrastructure and a global setup so that we get as close to that as possible in Paris this November. So those are two big campaigns we're focused on right now, where we work to get our membership all working together on things.
Right. Well, you know, it's just amazing to watch all this. The evidence among the scientists is so overwhelming that we are indeed experiencing climate change, and that, in fact, much of it is coming from human activity. And yet there's such a well-funded, orchestrated campaign of confusion of people trying to deny that there is an issue. We even have members of the U.S. Congress who are convinced that climate change is a liberal hoax to push this particular agenda. So how do you feel about what's happening with the pushback from the fossil fuel companies funding the climate denial attacks to try and slow things down?
Well, you know, it just has been revealed through a series of reports from Inside Climate, that which is an organization that has won the Pulitzer Prize for their reporting on climate change already once, that Exxon has known for many, many, many decades about climate science. And in fact, their own scientists gave briefings at the highest levels of their organization about the irreversible impacts of their product, and they chose, rather than disclosing this information and figuring out how to run the world on the sun and the wind and all the energy sources we know that we can get around on today through electrification of transportation, they chose instead a different path, a path of funding denial. And that is really problematic, that we have a very, very wealthy opposition that has, you know, is willing to engage in politics, engage in our democracy, skew our democracy, and put loads of money into making sure that we don't take the actions that we need to take in terms of, you know, using less electricity altogether, electrifying transportation, finding sustainable ways of getting around and mobility. And that's a real problem. And so we're starting to see some of that changing, but it's going to take a movement in order for that to change. It's going to take people getting involved in this movement. And so we have member organizations that people can join. And I always say there's a member organization for us no matter what your political leaning, your geography, or your orientation otherwise. We have a member organization that would love to invite you in to come work on climate action. And we really need people. We need people to be voting on this issue, because the only day that people have just as much power as the, you know, CEO of ExxonMobil is on election day. And we need to be using that power and voting on this issue and rising up together as a society. And that's part of why we designed this October 14th day also, is to give people an opportunity to be able to show that they are invested and that they care about the issue of climate change.
Yeah, I think that's awesome that you're doing that. And you know, it's such a shame. To me, the fossil fuel companies are kind of like the tobacco companies were. I mean, tobacco companies knew for decades that smoking was bad for your health, and yet they'd pay doctors get out there on television commercials and say, you know, smoking is good for you, don't worry about it.
Yeah. And it's not only the same tactics, it's the exact same individuals. And that's the thing.
Is that
so? I mean, like, yeah.
Who are they? So, do you know?
Well, I don't know their names, but this is all documented by the historian Naomi Oreskes. She wrote a book called Merchants of Doubt that's now been made into a film, and she documents the exact same individuals getting involved in fooling us on tobacco, getting involved in trying to fool us on toxic substances, and now getting involved in fooling us on climate science. And so I highly recommend the book and the movie to everybody. She's really done a great job documenting the tactics and the individuals involved. It's not that many people, but it's enough that they have savvy enough tactics and enough money that they're able to pull the wool over the eyes of politicians for decades. And in the case of tobacco, you know, a lot of people died, a lot of lives were lost.
Right.
As we were lying about tobacco. In this case, the consequences are much higher, and the consequences of every year lost is incredibly high because you have so much inertia in the Earth system. You know, I used to work at NASA, and one of the things that trained me to do was to think about the planetary scale and the scale at which we are changing our planet, the rapidity with which we are losing, for example, the polar ice cap. Like, these are massive effects that are really hard to turn around, and time is of the essence. And that's one of the things that's hardest for people to understand about this. It's a very different problem, because once it starts to get out of control and you hit tipping points, it's harder to go back. So it is incredibly, you know, dangerous that this is that we've got people out there still trying to tell everybody that the science is wrong, or the science isn't it, and give people false information. And there's a huge number of people who want to understand, want to believe that. And I understand. I mean, and that's very understandable to me. Of course, nobody wants to believe that, you know, these core things that have driven our society of fossil fuels are actually bad for us. I understand the desire to not want to believe that, but I can't understand the motivations, of people who, would actually, you know, go through such lengths to lie to the public. And one of the things that's in Merchants of Doubt is that she talks about those motivations, and that it's not really that these are people who hate science. It's that their mind jumps ahead to the solutions and they think it involves the big government, and because they don't like big government, it's easier in their brains to deny the problem than it is to, you know, come up with a solution that fits their mental model.
Oh, that's very interesting. Well, I definitely am going to read that Merchants of Doubt book and film, and maybe we can have the author on altogether now as a guest to expose some of what's going on. I think that's vital. Thank you so much for telling us about that. And I know when President Obama came in, he was very aware about the climate change problem. He brought the wonderful, brilliant, effective Van Jones in to be working with him on that. And originally, President Obama tried to get even the Republican approach to it with the cap and trade. You talked about, let's put a price on carbon. If you do cap and trade, was the Republican approach for how do you put a price on the carbon without massive, you know, government intervention. But when Obama tried to get that through Congress, the Republicans rejected their own plan and refused to pass it. So now Obama is working in other arenas. Recently, the Environmental Protection Agency is coming out this week, I understand, with some new regulations around climate change. Can you tell us, you know, why were you at the National Press Club in Washington this week, and what's happening now with the EPA?
Yeah, so there's a rule, there's a new rule under the Clean Air Act called the Clean Power Plan. And what this is, it's the first ever regulation of greenhouse gases from power plants, which are the largest source of greenhouse gases in this country. So it's pretty big. It's a rule that's propagated under the Clean Air Act. The EPA actually was required by a decision of the Supreme Court to make this ruling, and the Supreme Court decided that in the decision that if in fact greenhouse gases were a threat to public health, that the EPA needed to regulate them. And now we know that not only are they a threat to public health, but as I was talking about earlier, they're a deeply disproportionate effect on communities of color and low-income communities. And we see that in basic statistics like heat wave deaths, like with asthma deaths during heat waves. And so we know that it is a threat to public health, and now it is, you know, EPA's legal obligation and the White House's legal obligation to regulate greenhouse gases. And so that's moving forward for power plants under the Clean Power Plan. The plan itself has a 30% reduction by 2030, which is pretty modest relative to what is needed and what is achievable. And so we have, I think, 21 states that are already on track to meet the 2022 benchmarks of the plan, and 16 states that already are on track to meet their 2030 targets. So this is by no means a super aggressive plan, but it's an incredibly important step. Right now, greenhouse gases are unregulated in this country. We don't regulate the pollutants that cause climate change, and this plan changes that.
That's great. And the Environmental Protection Agency is going to be putting out this rules on greenhouse gas emissions from utilities. When does that take effect? Do you know? Is that like happening this week?
So the rule, the final rule came out this summer, and the detail, an additional set of details about the rule will come out on Friday, which is tomorrow. We also had a set of smog rules come out today and tomorrow, which are incredibly important a related issue about fossil fuels and pollution. But the rules are, you know, they are there. There's more final details coming out. They actually really, in some ways, go into effect in 2022. But there's a set of deadlines that come before then. So 1 year from today is one key deadline for the states. And basically what the rule does is give the states flexibility to come up with plans. And 1 year from today, states need to either ask for a one-year extension or submit their plan.
Okay, that's great. So we're making some progress. And this is a rule that President Obama can have issued through the Environmental Protection Agency without having to wait for Congress to do anything, which is...
Well, Congress passed the Clean Air Act, so they've done their job on this part, and President Nixon signed it, and so we have the Clean Air Act, and this is President Obama is, and you know, not to say there won't be legal challenges. We're anticipating thousands of legal challenges, and you know, there are attorneys generals of in states like Oklahoma that will challenge this ruling. But we are very, very confident that the rule is on very firm legal ground, and these are just kind of desperate attempts to keep us in the past and keep us in an era where, you know, corporate profits were more important than you know, our health or our children. And so I feel really confident that the rules will prevail legally and we'll be in a very different place once they're finally in place.
Fantastic. So just stepping back a bit, I know, you know, I live in Washington, D.C. We see the daily dysfunction that can be in there and the problems happening trying to get some good legislation through. If you had a magic wand and you could do anything to stop climate change or to deal with the climate change problem, what would you do? What do you think we really need to do? Don't be realistic, but just what do we need to do?
Well, there's four things that we need to do, I would say. One is we need to get off of fossil fuels and keep them in the ground. Two is we need to get to 100% renewable electricity. In order to get there, we would need this term I was talking about, a price on carbon, a carbon tax, a carbon fee, a carbon, you know, there are lots of ways of doing it, but to get to 100%, we probably would need that. We'd also need to remove fossil fuel subsidies. So there's all kinds of things you need to get to these things, but we need to keep fossil fuels in the ground, and we need to get to 100% renewable electricity. The third thing we need to do is we need to be prepared for impacts. There are some impacts at this point that are unavoidable. We've waited too long. We're currently experiencing 3/4 degrees Celsius of warming, and we're already seeing massive effects, and we need to be far more aware and prepared for the effects that will come and are coming. And so that preparedness is a key part of what needs to happen, is people getting real about, like, you know, we can't legislate away that sea level rise is happening. Like, North Carolina tried to pass a law that sea level rise could not be considered in their planning. Like, it doesn't matter what law you pass. The laws of physics are the ones that prevail when you're talking about the Earth system. And so we've got to get prepared. And then finally, we have got to think really, really hard and deep about what a just transition looks like. How do we help families that have been working in the fossil fuel industry? How do we make sure that there are family-sustaining jobs and jobs for everybody in this future we're talking about, and that people are protected? And so I don't have one thing for you, unfortunately, but if we did those four things, which are totally within our reach, then we would be ready for dealing with climate change.
That sounds great. I'm ready to vote for you for president.
Can we get I don't know.
Get that agenda going.
I'm curious why anybody wants that job.
Yeah, I'm not sure that Obama would recommend it at the moment, but there seem to be about 1,000 Republicans that want it and 4 Democrats, so we'll see what happens in 2016. But and speaking of the election coming up in 2016, what do you do in terms of advising candidates and elected officials on what should be done on climate change? Do you have kind of a legislative outreach arm, or how do you interface with elected officials?
Well, we don't, because of the way that, you know, our tax code is set up. We have, you know, these organizations that are 501c3 organizations and 501c4 organizations and political action committees. And so most of our member organizations are known as what's, you know, fall under that tax code of 501c3. So that means that we don't get involved in elections. That doesn't mean we don't tell people that they should vote on climate change, and we can do voter registration activities, but we don't actually get involved in elections. We certainly have member organizations that have, you know, arms of, that have 501c4s that run separately that get involved in elections. So many of our member organizations do that, but we don't, and our members are 501c3s primarily, and so So we don't get involved in elections other than sometimes, you know, spending some time calling for free and fair elections and a democracy that functions on behalf of the people, and then pointing out that we urge people to vote on the issue of climate change.
Right. Well, you can't get involved in supporting one candidate or another, but you can educate legislators at the state and federal level on what needs to happen. Which organization do you think is doing the best job at educating our elected officials on the issues?
Oh, this is like asking somebody which is their favorite child. I can't do that.
Okay. I encourage people,
if you go to our website, actually has a list of all 156 of our members, and you can look into each of them. My personal view is that they're all amazing, and that, you know, I think of our member organizations as, you know, the instruments in a symphony, and it's when they play together that we do amazing stuff. And the orchestra is not quite full up yet, so we need more, I would say. I would argue, even still, organizations weighing in on this issue. But everybody plays a really important role in this symphony, and it's together that we get things done. Everyone does really important work.
Right. Well, it's interesting. You know, I think that education work has been very effective, really, when you look at it. And the polls are showing that most Americans understand climate change is a real threat. And it's getting easier to see now than it was a couple of decades ago. But we can see the extreme drought in California, which is very scary, and the extreme snow in Boston last winter, where we got 7 feet of snow in 1 month. What do you think is the most effective way to mobilize the understanding that Americans have into promoting effective action, both personally and then as citizens with our government?
Well, it's a good question. I think at the personal level, it's maybe a different set of things from at the from the way that people vote. I think at a personal level, you know, in some people tend to do what's fun and what's easy and what's popular, and so in that sense, we have inertia on our side, because things like, you know, for homeowners, installing solar is following that diffusion process. You know, it's fun, it's easy, it's popular. It's actually, you know, gotten to the point where it's gotten out of just the innovators and the early adopters doing it. You know, a lot more people are starting to do it. Now, of course, that's not accessible to everybody. And so one of the things we're really focused on is programs that are accessible to everybody, and programs like, home insulation and programs like community solar that allow everybody in the community to buy into a little piece of a solar panel or a bit of solar panel. And so, you know, I think that those things are taking off, and we're definitely seeing some changes in behavior patterns that are heartening. I think that the number of miles driven in the U.S., for example, is plateauing and maybe even decreasing, depending on how you look at the data. It looks like we're on a positive trend on that front. And the three things in your personal life that make the biggest difference are around, you know, how you power your house, how you get around, both on a daily basis and, you know, for vacations, flying, and then what you eat and how you eat. So those are the things in people's personal habits that I see some positive trends and reason for hope. On the political front, you know, I don't really know the answer there. You know, the polls show that people are on our, you know, that people want climate action. It's just not, it's not a top tier issue. It's not jobs. It's that they're the daily issue that gets people incensed. And I think that that's where we have to help people engage on climate change in a way that that relates for them. Like, you know, the reality is that this is not something fair that we're doing to our children, and that, you know, and that's something that hopefully everyone can relate to, and something a lot of our member organizations are focused on is how do we get people to ask the climate question? How do we get people to go to a members forum and raise their hand and say, what's your position on climate change? And how do we get people even frankly to talk about this at the Thanksgiving dinner table to say, you know what I'm grateful for? I'm grateful that Shell pulled out of the Arctic and this China agreement happened because climate change worries me. People are afraid to talk about this issue, and we need to break through that and give people the courage somehow and the support to be able to have these conversations and to talk to people, whether it's their families or their elected officials, about climate change.
Yeah, I think that's great. And so in terms of the personal behavior, the three things people can do is, what did you say? One, your house, two, how you get around, and three, what you eat?
Yep.
Okay, so in terms of my house, I'm changing my light bulbs, doing insulation to try to reduce the demand on energy. I shifted from the coal fire plant into renewable energy sourcing. Fortunate enough here, I could do that. Is there anything else? Are those the kinds of things you're thinking about for we should be doing in our homes?
That's exactly right. Appliances are big. So the refrigerator is big. Heating and air conditioning is the biggest. So the insulation piece you were talking about is huge. Things like blinds, things like caulk, everything you're talking about is exactly right. You know, just getting the use down as much as possible often also increases the comfort of people's homes, because really you're just insulating it and making it a more comfortable temperature without having to use, dry heating. And, the air is nicer anyway if you can prevent using a lot of heating and air conditioning. So that's exactly right in the home. LED light bulbs and the most efficient appliances you can get. And I think the mistake people make most commonly is believing that their behaviors make a really big difference as opposed mm-hmm. to the things they own. And so you'll find a lot, there are studies that show that people really think that, for example, carpooling or turning out lights everywhere they go has a bigger impact than getting a more fuel-efficient car or changing your light bulbs out for LEDs. In fact, in almost every case, it is making that technology change that's going to have a bigger impact than the behavioral change.
Oh, that's very interesting. And as I'm from New England, and we're very big on being careful and not wasting. Waste not, want not is our motto there. But one of the other things we've done here is planted some trees, which I really was grateful we had done it years ago. But the trees that I planted years ago are now giving us some great shade. And believe me, I really appreciated the shade this summer. And it helped keep our house cooler, and it helped our air conditioning bill, our electric bill, be less high. So it's great stuff. And they're beautiful, too.
Yes.
So, and I thought for a while, years ago, that whatever I did wouldn't matter, because really what matters is what the companies are doing, what the manufacturers are doing, what the utilities are doing, and what difference does my little house make, or my car, if it gets 20 miles per gallon or 45 miles per gallon, what difference does it make? It's just one person. But what I've come to see is that what we do as individuals actually matters a great deal. And, one plus one plus one equals a million, and we get enough people making small changes, we have a big impact.
Yeah, and there's two other reasons it has a big impact. One reason that's been shown in a lot of research is because it does what's called signaling. And so when you start to do these behaviors, buy these products, invest in these technologies of the future, what it does is it signals visually and otherwise to the people around you, like, oh, that's what we're doing. So solar is an example of that, but so is, say, an electric car. But it's sending these signals to society that it's not so scary what we're talking about doing here, and this is the way we're going. The other thing I would say on the electricity front is that that's a case where even you don't need to get everybody to switch to make a huge difference. If you get enough people, if you get, say 1-2% of people using a lot less electricity, it becomes really, really hard for the utilities to operate without investing in renewable energy. And that's because when you start having a small percentage of people using less, whether that's because they install solar or because they, you know, insulate their homes heavily, then they're not selling that. They're not paying the utility as much, right? Because you're using less electricity once you insulate. So you're not paying the utility as much. Suddenly, then the utility can't pay back their loan on their coal-fired power plant, and then they can figure out how to do is usually go back and ask to raise rates. Once they raise rates, well, then they're even, you know, then there are even more people trying to save electricity and go on solar. And so it doesn't take very many people to have a big impact on the utility and convince the utility, oh, this business model is not working. We actually need to invest in energy efficiency and in solar.
Right. That's wonderful. That's very encouraging. We only need 1% to 2% of people changing to force the utilities to change. I love that. And then the second thing you talked about in terms of what we can do as individuals is how we get around. Do you mean driving less and driving cars that get greater miles per gallon, or what are you thinking?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, for those who live in urban centers, there are lots of options other than driving for mobility. You know, there's public transportation, there's riding bicycles, there's, you know, living near where you work. For people who live in more suburban or rural places, you know, electric cars have become, more and more available and be combined with renewable electricity. And these are things that pair very well together because only electric cars can store renewable electricity. So, for example, if you're overproducing solar, the car battery can hold it. And electric car batteries, electric car engines are also just more efficient than the internal combustion engine. And so there are different options depending on where you live. And for some people, this is probably, people who are more well off, but it's a pretty big chunk of this country. The biggest part of their personal carbon footprint, it comes from flying. For vacation, yeah. So it's not a huge part of global emissions, but for people who do fly to get around, it is by far the biggest part of their personal carbon footprint. And so that was certainly the case for me. So I wrote a book when I was on the train leave called The Zero Footprint Baby. This challenge we set out for ourselves as a family was that when my son was born, I had this enormous weight on my shoulders, first of all, because when I was pregnant, it just kept dawning on me that I was pregnant in 2010 and my son was going to be, not so different from my age when it was mid-century. And most of the climate projections that we read about are about mid-century projections. So you're reading about coral bleaching, sea level rise, more large wildfires, heavy downpours that are incredibly destructive. And I'm thinking about this stuff and I'm thinking I really have an incredible responsibility having made a choice in the face of the knowledge I have to bring a child to the world. And I want to try and do it in the most responsible way possible. So I wrote this book kind of laying out in each segment of my life what we could do so that our carbon footprint actually came down once our son was born. And we've been able to do that pretty much year on year. And for us personally, I'm a little bit embarrassed to say this considering most people in the world have probably never been on a plane and couldn't afford to do so. But for us, certainly, by far the biggest part of our personal carbon footprint was from flying. We were using the calculators that the aviation industry themselves put out there to calculate it, and there was just no way around it. So we've just started taking vacations closer to home, we don't visit our family quite as much as we used to, which is a shame. But we do it for longer periods of time when we do, so we're not making so many, flights to get around. And so it just, when I say mobility, I'm speaking broadly of just getting around, mm-hmm. whether there are ways of doing that, obviously other than driving.
Right. Very good. And there's always Skype. And I've noticed a lot fewer
exactly.
conferences lately and a lot more getting together by Skype and teleseminars, which is very encouraging.
Yeah, and I'm actually doing that tonight. I'm speaking at an event in San Francisco tonight via Skype. And that's another thing where I like doing things like that because it's just signaling to people that that's an option. And that once they try it, they might consider it for the next time they have a speaker.
Right, exactly. And So how did you get involved in this? We only have just a couple of minutes left, but how did you get involved into doing this amazing work you're doing?
Well, I was trained as a scientist, and I was working at NASA headquarters. And I for a while there, I thought I would be doing science for my career. But in 2002, and for me, it was a very discreet moment when I started working on climate change. In 2002, I was looking at Arctic sea ice data, and I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. And what immediately struck me was just the impact it would have on people all over the world in terms of food and in terms of water. And, like, the thing about losing the sea ice is that it's about 10 feet of sea ice in a lot of places. And it takes millions of years to build up this 10 feet of sea ice. And that's about twice my height. I'm reasonably short. But it just seems like a lot. Like, just picturing that and the amount of it that was disappearing. And at that time, it wasn't, you know, like, if you look at 2002 versus today, I mean, it's really shocking what we have allowed to happen to our planet and what, and the legacy that we're leaving to future generations. And it's especially shocking when you realize that the alternatives are right here and they're cheaper and they're here and now. And so that I just, I changed my career very quickly upon, seeing that data. And it's just been a journey since then.
Well, congratulations. I'm very grateful that you are doing what you're doing. And are you going to be in Paris for the upcoming climate change meetings there?
I will be, yeah. So U.S. Climate Action Network, my organization, is one of the U.N. focal points. So we help our members all coordinate around influencing and accessing the negotiations as they happen on the inside, and also try to help stay in touch with all of our member organizations who are on the outsides in the streets pushing for action and inviting the public to come join us in our struggle.
Well, that's great. And how can our listeners track what you're doing, and how can they learn more about your work?
Sure. Well, for folks who are on social media, my Twitter handle is Kaya_Chatterjee, and our organizational Twitter handle is USCAN. We also have a USCAN Facebook page. And again, peoplesclimate.org is the place where people can go and join an event near them or create an event near them for October 14th. And we'll also be keeping everybody who signs up there updated on opportunities to plug in on the UN Climate Talks in Paris and beyond through the coming years, because obviously things don't end in Paris. It's going to take a movement to shift things, and we're on our way to having one.
That's great. And you've got a website, usclimatenetwork.org. So that's all the time we have. Kaya Chatterjee, thank you so much for your important work and for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back next week. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.